Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to be white or black or Latino or Asian in America? And how much latitude do we have in deciding our own racial or ethnic identity? Rachel Dolezal stepped down last week from her post as head of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP after being confronted by a reporter who had discovered that while she identified and in fact represented herself as African American, the parents who raised her are both white. It's an odd story, to be sure, but it got us thinking about the odd nature of identity. If we accept that race and ethnicity are about more than genetics, but also about more than culture, what is required for anyone to claim membership in a particular group? And can we decide this aspect of identity for ourselves, or do we also have to get buy-in from other group members willing to accept us as one of their own? Jason Shelton is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington and author of the book Blacks and Whites in Christian America. Mariela Nunez-Janes is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of North Texas. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I think the reason I find this case so interesting is that, honestly, I have no idea how I should feel about it. Can you each talk about your initial reactions to the story and whether your thinking about all of this has changed in the days that have followed?
I have to admit that I actually purposely did not follow the story. I saw the feeds on my Facebook. I just glanced over the headline and just sort of shook my head and thought, you know, there are more interesting conversations about race and more pertinent ones. Here in Texas, we had just had an incident in McKinney, and I was following that very closely. In my own research, I'm recently working with undocumented immigrants, and so was following very closely what was happening in detention centers here in Texas, and then also thinking about the developing situation in the Dominican Republic.
So you feel like that this story getting so much attention, does it divert attention from things that are more important?
I think it does. I think it diverts attention from some of the struggles of people of color in the United States, as well as people of color across the world in terms of issues of oppression and racial justice.
What about you, Jason?
I thought it was fascinating from the beginning. I think that the idea that we live in a world where black folks have passed for white for centuries, if they can. We rarely hear the story where a white person is trying to pass for black. And that was fascinating to me, especially as a scholar who's interested in racial identity and the very things that essentially are the thrust of our show today. So here was the first time in the modern world in a very public setting where we had the chance to talk about the opportunity, the chance to talk about it, the situation as being reversed. Right. What does it mean for a white person to live in the shoes of a black person? We know a little bit about this from Black Like Me from the 50s, but nothing in the new millennium. And so I paid attention from the beginning. Thought it was fascinating. Still do.
There are certain aspects of our identity that we assume we can exercise a certain amount of control over. Right. We can choose our religion, our career, our political leanings, our physical appearance. We can alter that to a certain extent. Race is different, though. Not only is it assumed that we can't choose, but other people have a say in what our racial identity is, based in some cases on how we look to the world, whether or not that's an accurate reflection of who we feel we are.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really interesting about race, right? That as a form of identity, it does involve some kind of self-buying, right? It involves a sense of self. But that relationship also is a social one. So race is also an ascribed identity. So other people have to buy into it. And other people kind of inform your own sense of self racially as well. And so you have to be recognized as a racial person, right? And more importantly, I think in the United States, race operates in a way that is very static in the sense that you are born into a certain racial category, and supposedly you cannot shift that category. In other parts of the world, that's different, right? And in Latin America, for example, you can change your race. So this kind of phenomena is very uniquely American, I think.
I think that the things that you just said a minute ago are really interesting. I look at Rachel Dolezal's situation as sort of not all that unique in the sense that I think that right now there are some – the ground beneath our feet is moving in the United States of America. In the last month and a half, we've seen some pretty interesting things happen. We've seen Caitlyn Jenner declare being a male, right? Bruce Jenner. We've seen a major survey show the percentage of Americans who identify as Christian has fallen dramatically in just the last 8 years. We're seeing Americans' beliefs about gay marriage change dramatically. And then we're seeing Rachel Dolezal as well. And in my opinion, all these things are related in the sense that these ascriptive categories, right? Things that we thought for the last 50 years that are etched in stone, like race, like gender, like sexuality, like religion. Now we see more and more Americans saying, wait, hold up now. I can pick and choose a little bit here. And we didn't see this 50 years ago, right? And we saw it to a certain extent, but not the way that we are now. So in my opinion, Rachel Dolezal's situation is sort of emblematic of some of these deeper changes that we see. It's sort of like an advanced, a move towards like extreme individualism in the U.S. I get to pick and choose who I want to be. You may not like it, but it's my right to do it. And as we do that, tradition, as we thought we knew it, becomes gray. What it means to be black is now white in a lot of ways, or gray. What it means to be Christian, what it means to be male, what it means to be all these things that we thought were etched in stone seem to be up for grabs in ways that never have been in recent years.
I was fascinated in doing research for this show to discover that between 2000 and 2010, the way people described themselves on the U.S. Census and their racial or ethnic background shifted. And it was particularly notable for people who identified as, I guess the census calls it Hispanic, some people say Latino, and there were more options available than ever before. But it's interesting to think that people have this sense of themselves that may have shifted as it's more appropriate to be proud of a particular heritage that you have. And of course, we also have many more people in this country who identify as multi-ethnic or multiracial.
Yeah, and I think with Latinos in particular, it's a really, really interesting story because generally speaking, Latinos, in terms of race, self-identify more likely as white than Latino, right? But I think also that experience tells us something about the importance of social context, right? Latinos who are first-generation immigrants when it comes to race tend to self-identify as white, but not Latinos who have been in this country longer, right? So in part, what that tells is that they are assimilating the way in which we construct race in the United States.
It must be interesting for people who come from a place where everybody is Latino to then move to the United States and then realize, oh, wait, there's sort of a set of categories. There's a, you know, for better or for worse, truly a hierarchy in this country in terms of how people tend to be treated.
Yeah, and that's not to say that in Latin America there isn't a hierarchy, right? The one-drop rules operates, but it operates differently. As I mentioned before, you can change your race. So there's a phrase in Spanish that says, mejorar la raza, you can better your race, right? And you do that by marrying white or by getting an education or moving up the social ladder.
For African Americans, it's long been argued in sociology that we as black people had very few ethnic options, right? That I'm chocolate and we know which box you fit in, Jason, right? But what we're seeing now, especially in the last 30 years with the growth of black immigration in the U.S., now we're seeing that there are some wider choices available to some of us, not only just because of your ethnic background or your national origins, but who you marry, right? If you marry someone who's – if I'm black and I marry a woman who's white or Latina and my children come out differently, they live on a different racial line and different ethnic line. The wider – I guess my point here is that what we're seeing in the last 20, 30 years is a wider range of ethnic possibilities even for blacks. Not all of us, but some of us. And so that's where I – again, this argument about this bigger view about America and choices that we seem to have now that we haven't had before. Some of that even extends to us as African Americans.
So in the context of this intelligent conversation, we've dropped this phrase, one drop rule, which if people aren't familiar, this is throughout history, the assumption was that if you had even one drop of in the United States, it was black blood. If you had one black relative far back in the past, that you would be legally categorized as black and therefore you would be subject to all kinds to legalize discrimination. And as you mentioned, Mariela, it exists in a different way in Latin America. I think one thing that really struck me in light of the Dolezal situation is that we've all decided that we're really uncomfortable with the one-drop rule, and yet with Dolezal, she doesn't have the one drop, and therefore we can't allow her to claim a black identity, and it just presents a lot of interesting things to think about.
I fully agree with you. That's why I've been fascinated from the beginning. So think about Tiger Woods in the early 90s declaring that he's Coblin Asian. And most of us as African Americans were thinking, nah, brother, you black, right? You can be all these other things, but in the end, you're black primarily, and that's what the world will see you as. Right now, fast forward the clock, and we've had some other interesting instances. Remember when Bill Clinton, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are running for the Democratic nomination, Andrew Young, famed leader of the civil rights movement in the 60s, right-hand man to Dr. King, says that Bill Clinton is blacker than Barack Obama, right? And then you see Rachel Dolezal, right? Biologically, neither she nor Bill Clinton have anything black about them, but we know that, you know, recent research shows that we're 99% of the same genes. So what is race if we're the same on the inside, right? What that argument shows, what that research shows, is that how you feel about your ethnic identity is critical. Not only how you feel about it, but how others perceived you, as you mentioned a few minutes ago. So we're sort of at this point now where if race means nothing biologically, right, if race is socially constructed, which is a building block term in contemporary sociology, what does it mean to be a member of an ethnic group? Well, what Rachel Dolezal did is she feels like she's black. She looks like she's black. Black folks in the NAACP in Spokane, Washington made her the president of that chapter. She married a black man. She married black kids. She was living an African-American lifestyle, right? So is she less black or is she more black or less black? What are the answers here, right? And I think that this is fascinating for those reasons. Are we going to believe the one-drop rule, that Tiger Woods has to be completely black? Or are we going to back up from it and say, well, wait a minute here, what role does culture play? Big questions that we all have to answer, particularly African-Americans, in terms of defining what is black, who is black, and who is not black.
And I think in addition to that, though, we have to think about the context of those feelings, right? So where do those feelings come from and who has the choice or the opportunity to act upon them, right? And so as a Latina woman, I would never be able to pass for white. I could, right, in terms of my phenotype, but the minute I open my mouth, right, I sound Latina, right? And the same thing for black women and black men. They can act white, perhaps, but they could never pass for white. And so the question of choice and the question of opportunity is one that's tightly connected with the history surrounding the one-drop rule, right? Who's given those choices? Who's given those opportunities?
We know that in this country there are subcultures, right? There is African-American culture and Latin-American culture and Asian-American culture, we could spend all day talking about what those cultures actually mean. And then we talk about broad American culture. Is that still a sort of synecdoche for white culture, or is broad American culture something else that encapsulates white culture but also encapsulates black and Latino and Asian culture in this country?
I think that's a huge question. It's part of our national debate. Like, who really are we as Americans, right? We've gone from a metaphor of assimilation and trying to contend with maybe a metaphor of nationhood based on a salad bowl, right? Can we maintain our differences by forming some kind of identity together based on those differences?
I think that's a good question. So in one of my social classes, we talk about the contrasting assimilation theories, right? And one of the oldest and most popular one historically is the idea of the Anglo-conformity model.
Let me jump in a second. We have to take a quick break, and I want you to have time to finish your answer. We're speaking this hour with Jason Shelton, who's Associate Professor of Sociology at UTA, and Mariela Nunez-Janes, Associate Professor of Anthropology at UNT. We're talking about defining identity according to race and ethnicity or something else. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about how in America we define ourselves and our identities according to ethnicity and race. My guests are Mariela Nunez-Janes, who is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of North Texas, and Jason Shelton, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington, and author of the book Blacks and Whites in Christian America. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5377. Or email think@kera.org. Jason, before the break, you were about to tell us about the Anglo-conformity model.
So with respect to this question about how we view ourselves as a nation, right? Historically, the Anglo-conformity model has been the most popular idea. It's the idea that when minorities come to America, they essentially have to become white, quote unquote. The idea that regardless of where you're from, and think about particularly white ethnic immigrants, that if you're from Russia, if you are from the Eastern Bloc nations, wherever you are from in Eastern or Southern Europe, when you come here, you Americanize your name and you become like us. Put your culture behind you. And that was sort of the most popular way. As we move towards a new wave of immigrants, though, particularly those who were from other nations in Europe, I guess now the Southern and Easterns who were more Catholic, who had a darker skin color, the idea of the melting pot begins to emerge. And we as Americans like to view ourselves as that, which is essentially the idea that we can rub off on one another to a certain extent, that I get to keep my African-American culture and hip-hop and soul food, and that I can go live in the American mainstream and have friends who are Jewish who hold on to their ethnicity, or Latinas and hold on to their ethnicity, and we all sort of rub off on one another. A great number of Americans also think that's naive, right? So which one are we is still up for grabs. Is America a nation where assimilating means becoming white, or are we one where we essentially rub off? I think there's evidence on both sides of the equation for that.
Do we have to decide at some point? Will that be the solution to our struggles with figuring out who we are and what racial identity means? Do we have to decide whether American culture is something separate from all of the ethnic and racial backgrounds that we bring to citizenship here?
That's a great question. I think partly history tells us that we do, right? Or maybe that what we have to is engage in a process that lead us to perhaps some answers at one point or another, with more questions and then more answers and more questions, right? But we are kind of built as a nation on the notion of race, on the notion of rights, on the notion of privileges that are attached to human bodies, right? And those attachments are engulfed in culture. And so it is part of our nature, if you will, as a nation, to have to delve into these kinds of questions and relationships.
One explanation I've heard for why we find it so difficult to talk about race in this country in a way that moves the ball forward on the field is that as much as we might think we are doing so, we find it really hard to put ourselves in the place of people who are really different than we are, from a different category, racially or ethnically. How is it that we think we understand entirely what it means to be white or black or Latina or Asian or Native American or whatever, and yet fail to fill in so many of the details that actually truly inform the experience of people who are different than we are?
I want to address your point. I sort of want to go back to the previous question, though. This idea of do we have to decide? I think that a great number of Americans are in the process of deciding. I think that this is a longstanding question, right? This issue with the Confederate flag, this is a emblematic of us making a decision, a view of race. What is the symbol that we're going to buy into as a nation that reflects us, right? The symbol carries substance with implications for race. It tells us something, right? You mentioned the U.S. Census and the decisions that people are making, particularly young people, right, and their decisions about which categories to select on the box. As a nation, we might have this longstanding conversation about becoming colorblind or being post-racial, but clearly people are also making choices about their ethnic identity. We like some of those choices. We dislike others. My point is that I don't know if we, in a general overarching sense, are going to say, hey, look, here's how we're going to decide race. But I think we are at the micro level, at the individual level. We're constantly negotiating situation to situation, person to person, how we're grappling with these issues in terms of race. I do think that we're ultimately going to – that everyday people are reaching some sort of decision now, for better and worse, about what this means.
The Confederate flag thing that you raised is interesting because, you know, we've heard a lot of debate on this. Some people say it's an important symbol. Other people say, yeah, but that's not the issue right now. Right now we have to talk about violence, and these two things may or may not be related. But I've wondered why so many people feel like it's either one or the other. Either you take action by removing the Confederate flag and you're done, or you leave the Confederate flag in place and then take action elsewhere.
Well, as a black kid whose parents, grandparents grew up in a segregated South, right, that flag means something. And it means something to people, I guess maybe who look like me and who grew up in the culture that I grew up in. It means something. That flag represents something dramatic. It doesn't suggest welcoming.
Certainly.
It doesn't suggest equality, right? It does suggest history. That ain't the history I want to be a part of, right? Because the world that my little girls will grow up in is not the world. I don't want them in that world. We were in the mall the other day, and my little girl saw a young man who clearly had just come from soccer practice. And he had on Confederate socks, right? The socks went up to his kneecaps. And my little girl, who's 6 years old, he said, Daddy, he has the American flag on his socks. And I said, no, baby, that's not the American flag. It looks like it, Daddy, but it's not, baby. Why isn't it? And I wasn't ready to explain that yet, because I don't want my six-year-old to have that baggage quite yet. But at some point, she will, right? And that's not the baggage that I want her to see flying from the state capitol when we go visit relatives and friends in South Carolina. That's why that's important to come down.
Yeah, and I think just to add to Jason's point, too, there's certainly a power of symbols, right? And he explained that very well, of why the flag carries such symbolic power among blacks in the United States. I think just from an outsider perspective, if I will, we in the United States tend to think about single issues and single answers, right? We want to solve education with one single fix. We want to solve the racial problem with one single fix, right? If it wasn't civil rights, then what is it now, right? How are we going to solve it? And I think at the level of action at the moment, activists who are kind of engaged in grappling with these questions are having to make some tough decisions as well. But I think personally that we should address all of them. Symbols are powerful because they tell us something about the real story on the ground, right? And so actions need to be taken at the micro level as well as the macro level.
Yeah, and I guess the essence of my question, I was actually, I'll confess, surprised to learn that the Confederate flag was still flying in South Carolina. I just didn't realize this was still a thing, and I am ignorant that way. The question is there a concern that taking that down gives people a sense that they've taken care of the problem and now we've arrested the one individual instead of looking at the broader issues within society that give rise to people who are young and troubled and find the avenue to sort of express their rage in this like horribly racist destructive act?
Oh, I most certainly agree with you. When we all right, to bring it back to this idea of identity, what are the roots of identity, right? There are clear links between structure in society, culture in society, and of course our own selves, right? So the circumstances, the environment that you grow up in has a lot to do with how you view yourself. And the culture that's in that environment has a lot to do with sort of the day-to-day life that you in terms of how you'll see yourself. So when you think of this, the flag coming down, that's an important symbol, right? But the substance, i.e. the inequality, will remain after the flag is down. We live in a nation where we have made a lot of progress, but we still have a long way to go in that racial inequality, ethnic inequality is alive and well. When you look at poverty rates for blacks and Latinos, when you look at education rates for blacks and Latinos as compared to whites. So just because the flag comes down, we can't think, hey, game over, right? What it will show is that this is a major step in the right direction. But the more meaningful change is the amelioration of the structural inequality, which will lead to clear equality, which will ultimately lead to the sense of why people identify with their groups, right? Once you eliminate inequality, then you have a fair and equal playing field, and people can say, hey, I'm just an American now, right? When you look at the research on people who say that they are just an American, they tend to have higher levels of income. They tend to be more assimilated into the American mainstream. So inequality and identity are closely connected.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Hulsey in Dallas. Hi, Hulsey.
Hi. I really appreciate this program. And my question is this. Is the concept of race a manufactured false category which has been used to justify the oppression of black people?
I would say that intellectually it was manufactured, and in part it was anthropologists who contributed greatly to that manufacturing in that process. I mean, we know that biologically race has no meaning, and so perhaps part of the confusion is to think about the difference between race as biology, which we know is non-existent, and race as a social construct or social race. And in that sense, we've been inventing stories, biological stories, social stories, about what race means over time.
I agree completely. But that's where I think the Rachel Dolezal case gets really interesting, because if race is a social invention, and it clearly is in terms of genetic research showing that we're all the same on the inside, then what does it mean when a white woman who looks black and has convinced other people that she's black and is treated by other people that she's black and says she's black all of a sudden, right? That means that if race is not real biologically, then it is real socially in her mind. And so she really believes that she's black. There's a story right here I saw on USA Today just yesterday of a black woman, I think in the Houston area, who realized that she was adopted years and years ago, and she has lived her entire life as a black woman. But when her adopted mother was on her deathbed, told her, you were adopted from a white family. And so now all of a sudden, does this woman who's 70 years old start to look at herself? Is she a white woman now for the rest of her life? She said she feels like a black woman. That's the same thing that Rachel Dolezal said, right? They feel like a black woman. Black people have accepted them as black. White people have said, yes, we think you're white. We think you're black. So this is where we get to the subjectivity of the question of what is race. The uncomfortable part of this is that if it's true that race is not real biologically, then that means that what we think is black, what we think is white, what we think is Latina is very nebulous. And that means that people can move across those boundaries in ways that we don't want them to move. I suspect that that's not going to happen on a macro level, right? Because few people want to be associated with the inequality of blackness and Latino-ness. But it is possible, right? And Rachel Dolezal shows us that.
Some people have worried that the Dolezal case gives credence to people who believe that we are done with our problems with race in this country, and that if you have a white woman wanting to be black, the only motivation she could possibly have is to gain some advantage over by declaring a black identity. And therefore, this demonstrates that somehow racism is over in America. I don't know that this is a widespread view, but, you know, you hear it in certain kinds of radio stations, not this kind. So what do we do with that?
Yeah, I think, again, the idea here is that there's a dismissal of the social reality of race, right, and the implications of being racialized in the United States right now and also historically. There are privileges that come with certain racial categories. There are privileges that come with being white. And part of that is that privilege of choice, right, that people of color, when it comes to race, often don't have.
Well, what I think is sort of overlooked in a lot of this Dolezal story is that I think it's fascinating that she would choose to be black. We live in a society where African Americans, by all measurable statistics, are second in terms of income, education, quality of life, health, all this stuff. Yet this privileged white woman wants to say, hey, look, I want to be a part of that, right? What I think is overlooked is that in a lot of ways, Rachel Dolezal shows that there's something enjoyable and nice about being black, that there's something, we have a culture that people want to be a part of, right? I go to rap concerts all the time. There's always white folks there, but they don't make that extreme what Rachel Dolezal did, to live in the skin, to enjoy the music, to be around a group of black people and experience that subjective aspect of the culture. She chose that. And I think even we as African Americans tend to overlook that part, that she found the enjoyable nugget that most of us like to live in. And she said, hey, I'm willing to sacrifice the white part. I'm willing to sacrifice to being called an N-word. I'm willing to sacrifice a lot of the things that maybe I could have had if I didn't darken my skin and live this black life for the enjoyable aspect of that black culture that you guys seem to be living.
There is still the question of why she would need to present herself as having this identity as opposed to saying, I love the culture. I would imagine that her black friends, had they known she was white, wouldn't have said, you can't come hang out with us anymore. You can't, you know, fight for the same causes we believe in. Again, I think the fact that she presented herself this way speaks to the fact that we're all expected to, like, pick one category. There may be many of them now on the census form. There may be opportunities to present ourselves as multi-ethnic or multiracial, but we're all expected to divine ourselves down to one category.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for herself, right, because we will never know exactly the reasons behind her choices. And there's lots of sort of stories about her parents and her brother and sort of turmoil within the family. And those are very unique to individuals and to this particular situation. I would say that there is a kind of sense that we have to have some kind of oppression capital or racial capital, right? So that the assumption that if we want to speak about Latinos, you should be Latina, right? And if you particularly want to speak about that oppression, then you should be part of that group. And as Jason said, sort of forget about the kind of camaraderie as well that happens when we self-identify with others. So perhaps it was that camaraderie that she was seeking that maybe she did not find in her family. I also think that on the other hand, we have this sense that we have to be the same to be able to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, right? And so I think we can think about the black experience from a white perspective or from a Latino perspective without necessarily changing our racial identity.
We're speaking this hour with Mariela Nunez-Janes, who is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of North Texas, and Jason Shelton, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington, about defining identity according to race and ethnicity in America. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are talking this hour about how we define identity in America according to race and ethnicity with my two guests, Jason Shelton, an associate professor of sociology at UTA, and Mariela Nunez-Janes, associate professor of anthropology at UNT. You can join us at 800-933-5372. We have Jessica on the line in Rowlett. Hey, Jessica.
Hi. I was just calling. I kind of had a little anecdote. My husband is multiracial, his mother is Latina, and his dad is white. And growing up, his mom has told me stories about her being out with her son, who looks more white than Latino, and being questioned about if she was a friend or the babysitter, or just people not realizing that that was her child. And just kind of how that impacted her, you know, in a negative way. As when I met my husband, I asked him, I said, well, do you feel more Hispanic or do you feel more white? And he said that he felt that people treated him probably more white because he looked more white, but he didn't he doesn't feel a certain way. But he has family that is from Mexico, and he has a family that has lived in America as long as we can remember. So to him, it was more of how people treated him, not so much how he felt personally.
Thanks so much for your call. It's an interesting perspective.
I have a class that I teach entitled Latinos in the U.S., and often we interview Latinos for the class. And years ago, there was a person that was interviewed who was of German descent and also of Mexican descent. And this person chose to call herself Germsican. and so it's a very complicated question, especially for Latinos. And we were just sharing off the air personal anecdotes. In my case, I am a Latina with a child who phenotypically looks white. And I wonder when I'm walking around the mall with her or when I'm at swim lessons with her alone without my husband, what other people are thinking.
Do you care what other people are thinking?
I intellectually, I know I shouldn't. Personally, I know that I do. And in just my personal experience, it's been surprising to me how much I do.
The other thing we really haven't touched on is the way that our ideas in this country about race and ethnicity are also informed by economic privilege, social class. And it's really, it seems to me that it's impossible to tease out completely how those two factors interact in any of us forming our identities.
Oh, yes. I mean, in sociology, one of the raging debates for the last 20 years is the question of what's more important in the course of an African-American's life. Is it race, i.e. the color of your skin that shapes opportunities and what you experience in the United States of America? Or is it your class position? In other words, regardless of what I look like, how much education do I have, where do I live, what have I been able to expose my children to, those kinds of things. Raging debate in the discipline, evidence on both sides of the equation. But what is clear is that in the post-civil rights era, like when I said my grandparents grew up in the segregated South, what drove life for my grandparents in Birmingham was the color of their skin. Their grandboys grew up in Ohio and went to suburban schools. Social class plays a meaningful role in our lives. The career that I have now versus careers that even people in my own family haven't had, right? And so income, education, all of these things shape the way that you think about your experience as a member of a minority group, right? Whether we're talking about black people, whether we're talking about Latinos, whether we're talking about Asians, your income, your education, where you live, all of these things shape your social network. What kinds of black people am I around on a regular basis, right? What kinds of black kids will my kids be around on a regular basis, right? These are big questions that are shaped by social class, right? So race and class are intertwined. They're difficult to disaggregate, but clearly these are important issues.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Linda who writes, "Why don't we lump all whites into a single culture, white? There are many cultures made up of white-skinned people. I don't relate to some of them."
I think it's an interesting question. When you think about American history, think about, let's go back to early immigrants, right? Think of the 1850s, right? The Irish and Germans in big numbers.
Ruining everything.
Right, for sure, right? And then you think about the big turn of American immigration in the 1880s, right? Now we're getting more white people, but they look different, and they come from different parts of the world. So my point here is that when we think about white culture in the U.S., in quote-unquote, it is very diverse, especially historically, right? When you look at survey research now and you ask whites where their what nations their ancestors came from, a wide range of nations are going to be listed. The key, though, is that in the modern world, those whites ultimately come to view themselves as white, less in their national origin. A few white folks run around today saying, hey, look, I'm from France, mm-hmm. right? But what they do say is, I'm an American. And what you clearly see with the passage of time, and this is where assimilation comes in, is that, yes, they have different national origins, but this idea of a broader sense of whiteness has emerged, particularly in the last 100 years, that whites who are here longer identify with, rather than their national origin.
And of course, that option's not necessarily available to everyone. I mean, I don't know anything about your family, Jason, but you know, they might have been here far longer than my family. But you know, the fact I've lost touch with my ethnic heritage doesn't mean that I'm treated as something different than white.
Right, for sure. There's a fascinating research by a scholar at Harvard named Mary Waters, and Waters argues that for whites, ethnicity is still alive and well, but it has taken on a symbolic dimension, i.e. if I'm Irish, I get up for St. Paddy's Day, right? Every other day of the year, I'm just white, but right. It's St. Paddy's Day, right? Go get my green, drink some beer, we're going to have a good time. We're going to celebrate being Irish today, this symbolic element. And so, again, that diversity is there, but how meaningful is it in terms of driving the course of your everyday life? So, again, researchers are saying, yes, there is diversity in white America, but how meaningful is it to your everyday life?
Yeah, and I think part of the also the essentializing of white diversity, if you will, was a strategic necessity for the purposes of claiming so-called biological inferiority and superiority. So for whites to claim superiority, then they had to all be lumped into one single category.
Another interesting factor, I think, for Latino identity in this country, and certainly one could argue that we lump Latino identity into one thing when it means something very different to come from Mexico or Cuba or South America. Those are really different cultures that I think a lot of Americans don't really understand the distinctions between. But because of the way that immigration has moved in the past few decades, we continue to see newcomers to this country who identify as Latino, whereas many other groups, you know, small numbers of people come on a regular basis, but not large numbers of people who will continue to influence the development of those cultures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for the question of race, Latino identity is one to watch, right? What happens to Latinos, how Latinos end up identifying themselves, how they end up being identified by others, is a really, really important question for kind of helping us disentangle the meaning of race in the future.
Does it, I mean, where do you come down on the question? You know, there are people who, I don't know that this is true of scholars, but there are people who say being Latino is not so much an ethnicity, it's they consider it their race. And we've already talked about race being a fabricated construct, and yet what's the difference between ethnicity and race with regard to Latino identity?
That's kind of like the race and class question in sociology, right? In Latino studies, are Latinos a race? Are Latinos an ethnicity? Is a classical question. I think they can be defined as both, right? And Latinos have certainly been racialized historically in the United States, where sometimes they were considered to be black, and sometimes they were considered to be white, right? More recently, Latinos have been racialized like blacks in terms of criminalization of their experiences. But culturally, we can see that certainly Latinos are rich and diverse and that the traditions are alive and well, if you will, in part as a result of constant immigration. And so I think the question of whether they're a race or whether they're an ethnicity in practice is meaningless, right? They're obviously an identity. They're obviously a group that whose meaning in the United States is sort of being negotiated, right? Where do they fit in? What do they mean in terms of whether they are American or not or whether they can become American or not? I think it's a more kind of interesting question.
We famously in this country, it's hard to have candid discussions about race, right, for a variety of reasons. And it's understandable why this is difficult when you have, all parties sort of inclined to come into the discussion ready to dislike or distrust one another. Why is it still so hard when people, if they have any kind of inherent bias, really want to stamp that out within themselves and they really want to understand, and yet we still have a hard time with frank conversation. What are we missing?
I think what it is that the idea, and Mariela tapped into this a few minutes ago, the idea of privilege. Membership has its privileges, right? The old American Express saying, right? That when it comes to being white, right, you get a lot more passes than you do with other other affiliations. Hence why I think I'm so fascinated with Rachel Dolezal, right? Because that privilege is tremendous, right? I get a few passes as a professor, but when I'm walking through the mall or when I'm at the rap concert and I'm not in Dr. Shelton mode, I don't get a lot of those passes anymore, right? I have to show clearly my social class markers to say, hey, look, you don't have to worry about me.
How do you do right? that?
You the dress
way you speak, a certain
way. The way you speak. Well, when I'm going to the rap show, you can imagine baggy pants, backwards hats, right? Mm-hmm. And sort of, but those indicators are gone. But at the rap show, that's one thing. When I'm walking around in regular society, it's different, right? And so you have to sort of be able to show what these indicators are. You have to sort of show affiliation in these different sorts of ways. But there are privileges to being white. There are privileges to being middle class and black. There are privileges to being middle class and Latino. There are privileges to these things. We don't get the same sort of privileges across the board, but we negotiate them differently from situation to situation. I had a friend of mine who was arrested by the LAPD or was going to be arrested by the LAPD, but he was able to pull out his mom's business card to show that she was attorney. She was an attorney. Oh, we know you. You're okay. You're cool. Hmm. Right? When you can show those indicators, right, you can dramatically change the situation, right? And that's the privilege that some of us have that others don't.
Yeah, and a conversation about privileges and also oppressions is an emotional conversation. In the context in which I've had this conversation is in my classes, right, where we talk about race, we talk about ethnicity. And it's often very, very difficult to have to think about spaces, public spaces like a classroom as a place in which you display emotion, right? And so we need to perhaps, and I know this is going to sound a little strange, right, coming from a scholar, but I think we need to be able to start thinking about the possibility of putting our emotions on the table when we have these conversations.
Why is it so hard for white people to recognize white privilege?
I actually think for some of them it's hard to see because it's right here on their nose, right? And I honestly believe that white folks see a lot of the inequality among whites, right? You listen to what white folks talking about in terms of, and I didn't invent this term, but poor white trash. Black folks didn't invent that term either. It comes from something that was long before we had access to it, right? My point here is that white folks recognize inequality among them, right? And white folks are able to say, hey, look, he's poor because he's lazy. But at the same time, because they can say he's poor because he's lazy, they have a difficult time. And I'm not saying, let me not say they as in all, but many have a difficult time equating or bringing race into that and seeing the compounding factors of segregation, the compounding factors of inequality, the compounding factors of, yes, even slavery, going back generations, that all these things sort of accumulate. The same way among poor whites, there's this additional layer for poor blacks and other Latino groups as well, Mexicans in particular, I would argue, in the U.S., right? And so I think for whites, they see inequality, but they don't want to recognize the racial aspect of it, because if you recognizing the racial aspect of it sort of says, okay, there's an ugly part here that
there's
we may not want to. Right. There's a different part here, right? And so I think many whites see the inequality, but saying that it is the racial inequality, but saying it is the primary factor or a key factor, I think they're not ready for that.
Jason Shelton is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Arlington and author of the book Blacks and Whites in Christian America. Mariela Nunez-Janes is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of North Texas. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is Associate Producer. She had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. And our Executive Producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.